This is an ABC podcast.
We've changed the world in a way that you rarely get an opportunity to do that. The Senate has now passed the most significant bill to fight the climate crisis ever. And it's going to make a difference to my grandkids.
United States politician Chuck Schumer, after the Senate passed a climate change bill to the tune of $360 billion US. This comes only days after the Albanese government passed its own bill through the lower house. Today, we're going to speak to one of the world's most foremost thinkers on the future of how we power our world, Australian inventor Sol Griffith. He was an advisor to the United States President Joe Biden, but now he's left the States and lives back here in regional Australia. And he has plans for this country. I'm Sinead Mangan, and this is Australia Wide, coming to you from Whadjuk Country. What if your town or suburb could be the template for a new electric future? My guest today, engineer and entrepreneur Sol Griffith, believes we should electrify absolutely everything and wants to prove it here in Australia. He says everything we use should run on electricity, our cars, our tractors, our heating systems, and in turn, power will become cheaper and cleaner. A former advisor to US President Joe Biden, Dr. Sol Griffith is now back in home in Australia, living in the Illawarra region of New South Wales. And he believes when it comes to generating electricity via wind and sun, Australia is in fact the lucky country. And for us consumers, the cost of generating that energy and storing it is dropping quickly and quicker than we all realise. Dr. Sol Griffith joins me now. Dr. Sol Griffith, nice to chat.
Thank you very much.
Now, let's look at the big picture first. Now, we've been talking, it seems like, for a couple of decades now in Australia about the reliance on fossil fuels hitting peak oil. That was something that was talked about a lot in 2000s and the hurdles to changing that. But you come to this argument in very simple terms, really, and it isn't about missing out on stuff. It's about tapping into the abundance that's here in Australia. What do you mean by that?
I think in 2000, when you were having a climate debate, you couldn't really have it with the solutions. So you'd be talking about how to eliminate the emissions from our vehicles, but no one really believed that electric vehicles would be the answer. You could talk about rooftop solar, but it still felt like an expensive thing. And you could talk about batteries for storage, but they felt like they were a long way off and also too expensive. If you come back to that conversation now in 2022, you can look at that bag of goodies and the prices are coming down incredibly quickly. And you can look at the cost of ownership of an electric vehicle over its 20-year lifetime compared to a petrol or diesel. It's much lower. You can look at the cost of ownership of an electric water heater instead of a natural gas one. It's much lower. Even your electric cooktop, cheaper to go electric. And all of this, in some respects, is driven by the miracle that there's rooftop solar in Australia, which, because it cuts out the transmission and the distribution lines and just delivers electricity straight to your house, it turns out that that's the cheapest electricity that Australian consumers have ever had. The other nice thing about it is that it's inflation proof. So if you look at the 30, 40 year history of the price of natural gas or the price of petrol or diesel, even the price of coal and grid-based electricity, they have all been increasing year on year a little faster than inflation and a little more than 3%. That will continue to happen for the next 20 years for those fuels, or it might even get worse, and it will definitely get more volatile as we go through this transition. Whereas if you went out and bought solar today, put it on your roof, once it's installed and financed, you're just paying those finance costs for the next 20 years, and it's delivering you electricity at 5 to 6 cents a kilowatt hour for the next 20 years. So it holds that price constant. It's already a good deal, but the even more extraordinary statement is that anything you electrify now is an appreciating asset because it's only going to get cheaper to run compared to the fossil fuel machine. So, you know, some environmentalists might not love it, that we now have a substitution model. You just take away the bad machines and replace them with good machines. Quite honestly, that's what we can do. We don't have to change the fabric of Australian life to get to zero emissions. We just need to electrify all of the machines and run them on our enormous abundance of solar and wind.
You're saying there about, you know, in terms of solar, that's kind of the ticket into this for Australians. And 30% of Australians have, like, our uptake of solar is something to be admired worldwide. I don't know, as a consumer, that understanding of how much batteries cost right now and EVs cost right now, like the, weighing that up right now, it would seem like it's too costly. When are those costs going to sort of make sense for the everyman in terms of their back pocket?
So we're caught a little bit right now because of COVID and because of the war in Ukraine and because of global supply chain issues, that electric vehicles are a little slower to fall in price than they otherwise would have. And batteries are a little bit pinched in the same way, but everyone, all the big companies are expanding their battery manufacturing facilities enormously. So the cheaper batteries are coming. They've already come down by a factor of 10 in price in the last 10 years. So they'll come down by more than half a couple more times. If you can afford to finance it, it works today economically. If you can't afford to finance it, then it'll work for you by about 2025 when it will start to work for everyone.
So you're saying in 3 years' time, most people would be able to afford both rooftop solar and batteries to match?
Well, let's be careful with the word afford. Many, many people who buy solar or buy a battery or do these projects of electrification do them when they refinance their house, because they're large capital expenditures in the context of your life. So for people who are homeowners, this is something that becomes very affordable the next time you upgrade your kitchen, or the next time you need a vehicle, or the next time you need a hot water heater. If you have the finance and the credit capacity, it makes sense economically over the life. You know, the water heater lives for 10 years. It'll save you the money over 10 years. If you're pinched for cash and you can't get, don't have good credit, and you're a renter, not an owner, it's still quite difficult.
Yeah. And well, how long do you think that will remain the case?
That could remain the case for quite a long time, unless the government really becomes quite activist in addressing that inequity.
And what do you suggest they do?
So, you know, the lowest 10 or 20% of households in Australia and social housing, that could, the government has a big role to play in that. Aligning the financial incentives so that landlords pass on these, say, electrify and clean up these buildings and pass those savings on to their renters is another aspect. Thinking about creative ways that traditional bank style credit can be extended further down the socioeconomic ladder by using government based guarantees. This is in fact how the Australian mortgage market originally and still works, same in the US. If you're in the richest 10% of households in Australia, you can go out and do this today. And there's, you know, there's no reason not to be a zero emission household already. The next 40 or 50%, they're the people who are going to have to do it on their house, home equity or some other mechanism like that. And I think the bottom 50% or maybe a little bit less, 30%, it's going to be a struggle unless we figure out how to access those lifetime energy savings at the point where you're buying the piece of machinery. I mean, if you're from a low-income household and your hot water heater goes out and you go to Bunnings or to Harvey Norman, you're going to buy the cheapest machine, and it's going to be the natural gas one, even though the natural gas that goes through that machine over the next 12 years will cost you a few thousand dollars more than the electricity for the electric one.
What about EVs in terms of breaking into the Australian market? You said COVID had kind of set that on the back burner a little bit. What's holding it up here in Australia that there's very little choice and that they're pretty much a luxury car right now?
We don't have an emissions standard. So we get the dirtiest vehicles from the world's automakers. If you're Ford, there's every motivation to make the electric vehicles that California wants and to sell them in California, because California has very stringent air quality standards, which are good for your health, as well as meaning they absorb all those electric cars. So Australia's last in line. In fact, Ford, that now makes a $40,000 SUV that is a little bit bigger than the Ford Ranger in every dimension and has a 500 kilometer range. They make an electric version of that truck. It's called the F-150 Lightning. They've stopped taking orders in the US because they can't keep up with demand. In fact, for all of the electric trucks that are coming, the bookings are 1 or 2 years out, all saturated just in the US and European markets. So Australia's mistakes on vehicles occurred 10 years ago. It's hard to fix this with policy now. We stopped making our own vehicles. We don't have a domestic electric vehicle industry. We are reliant on those imports, and we're last in line because we have no emission standards. So, you know, we are paying premium and we're having to wait for it.
Well, hopefully, you know, that will change and electric vehicles will be more available on the market. But in the bush, there's certainly a massive anxiety around range when it comes to EVs. How can that be addressed?
There's 6,500 petrol stations in Australia. So, you know, right now there's only a few hundred charging stations. So one way this will be solved is every pub, every, you know, every Coles, every Harvey Norman, every IGA, every school will have charging facilities. I drove about 10,000 kilometres around the country on a book tour this year with my mother in an electric vehicle. We never got stuck, never really had any problems.
You did 10,000 Ks. 10,000 Ks and you didn't get stuck?
Nope. No.
Where did you charge up?
There's already, you know, we drove from Sydney to Adelaide to Melbourne to Hobart, back to Melbourne to Canberra to Sydney and sort of did variations of that twice. Every town already has vehicle charging stations. And then some nights we'd stay overnight in the pub and they'd let us charge out the back in the parking lot. And you wake up in the morning and you're ready to go. The charging network, there are some beautiful vehicle charges where you get to sit by the river for half an hour and have your lunch and throw a few stones. And then the vehicle's charged and away you go. Mm. You know, the convenience could go up, but it's going to go up by having more vehicle charges. The range of the vehicles is going up. You can now buy a Toyota Hilux size and shaped car in the US called the Rivian. It comes with a 180 kilowatt hour battery that'll easily do 500 or 600 kilometers, probably more if you're not going super fast on the highway. So in mixed traffic, it probably does closer to 750 kilometers.
Right.
So I'm not worried. The batteries are getting there. Yes, today you can't get exactly the car you want if you want a particular kind of vehicle. But what we need to be planning for as a nation is that all of these cars are coming. I went through the complete list of the world's automakers last week. The majority have decided to not make a petrol or diesel vehicle after 2030. And it's a few stragglers by 2040. And the only major automotive company not to commit to going to zero, making zero petrol and diesel vehicles is Toyota. Everyone has decided that this is the future and these are going to be the only cars you'll be able to buy by roughly 2030. So Australia, whether you care or not, like, we have to plan for this because it's happening.
So what about for people who do love their diesel cars? And, you know, I'd imagine people, as you were rocking up to the pub with your mum, were kind of checking you out a bit in your electric car. And yeah, what's the attitude there when you chat to people?
I don't know. I'm a car guy. I know how to crack the rail on the diesel, and I own a 63 Land Rover with a Brazilian tractor engine in it. And I appreciate the black smoke as much as the next guy. Not every single vehicle will go electric. You did say that in the intro to the show, but we do in Australia have enough resources to make some biofuels. We can't use biofuels for the whole fleet, but we will be able to use it for a small number of vehicles. I have found in my life, and I'm now owning my fourth electric vehicle, that just because of the practical realities of where the vehicles are so far, we still keep around one diesel vehicle. That'll be true for a few more years. But, you know, I anticipate that the electric pickup truck that I buy in 2027 will mean that I never have to own diesel again, and it'll have four times the torque of any diesel truck I've ever owned. It will go five times as fast. It will be quiet. Won't smell horrible. I mean, yes, I know how to speak carburetor as a native language, but I don't miss the oil, the grease and the coolant. I think most people will have that experience. Turns out our emotional relationship with the vehicle is mostly with the sheet metal, not with the dirty bits.
With the sheet metal, as in the outside?
Outside shape. We develop emotional attachment to, you know, the 67 Monaro and the LJ Tirana, but like, it's the shape, you know, the silhouette, the icon.
I would have thought the sound might have been part of it too, though, in terms of a Monaro or something. You know,
yeah, I don't know.
Losing that sound, is that going to lose something for people, or they just need to get over it?
I've now built retrofitted a few vintage classics as electrics. And once you have, I think the expression, excuse my tongue, is ball-tearing acceleration of electric cars in that 67 Monaro, you'll never look back. You won't miss the noise because you're going too fast to, you know, you're outrunning the noise.
So if we, you know, move out to industry, the ag industry, the mining industry, the farmer in his, you know, out in his paddock, what does it mean for them? Will they be able to leave diesel behind?
You know, some of the diesel... For the very large combines, you know, batteries are still away from being able to do that. In Norway, they're already starting to electrify the tractors and farmers love it. They're higher torque, easier and lower maintenance, all of the good things. But for some of the big equipment, it'll take a while. The batteries might get there, the batteries might not, and we'll run them on some sort of biofuel or biodiesel. I think that happens later in the decarbonization project. I'm not talking 2060 later, I'm thinking mid-2030s. That's appropriate to hitting the climate targets that we need. But, you know, inner city people who have Honda Civics, they're first up as the cars that we can build today electrically that have much better performance than what you're buying in those categories now. But for the high demand, high torque, high power agricultural vehicles, they might be somewhat slower. Although I think you'll be surprised, the freight transport, the electric trucks are coming. They're just going to be so much cheaper to own and operate as fleets that I think a lot of the trucking will go electric much faster than people anticipate.
Some of the anxiety around kind of moving to a renewable and to an electrified future is around jobs, particularly for regional Australia, where fossil fuels may have been a big part of the makeup of the jobs that are in town. How does that argument stack up?
You know, about 85 or 90% of our electricity emissions come from 13 or 14 power plants that are in specific community, very often co-located with coal mines. So there's a small number of rural communities that will be quite heavily hit as some of those facilities go offline. But for the great majority of, and you know, I'm very sympathetic to those communities, and I think we should have transition plans. Very likely pumped hydro and transmission projects will happen where those communities are. There's logical reasons to do that, historical reasons, save the jobs reasons. So I think there's even a good upside for those towns, even though they're going to have to make some changes. But for the majority of rural Australia, this is all good news. Think about a small town of 1,000 people in rural Australia today. You have to buy all of your oil and all your petrol and all your diesel, and it's imported and it's hugely expensive. And the community probably spends $5 million a year doing so. That money creates one job at the local petrol station, selling you know, nicotine and sugar and oil, three things that kill you in one spot. But it's not creating much economic activity in your community, and it's money that's leaving your community on a one-way ticket. Same with natural gas, to be honest. Very few rural communities make their own natural gas, so they have to pipe it in. And so that's money, again, leaves the community. If you think about what happens just in the local community economy when you're starting to run your community off solar and off community wind projects, which is very possible in rural Australia, then effectively you're powering your cars and your tractors with local money, local savings, local jobs. When you run the numbers, it looks like it's a net job creator for every community, because you're going to be building more of your own infrastructure to power more of your own things. And then you're going to have these savings. And because that money is being spent in your community, it's going to create a lot of jobs in your community, and not just energy jobs. But because it will be cheaper and you'll be saving a few thousand dollars a year, you'll be spending more money at the pub, at the restaurant, at the sports centers in the sports field, on the arts. And so you actually see an incredible opportunity for community economic revival, particularly in rural Australia. So I think the culture war was successful in having rural Australia believe that they had everything to lose. But I think the much closer to the reality is that they have everything to win.
Aside from the job front, there's this other argument about like wind turbines, solar array. They take up huge amounts of land. That's, you know, it's not in, you know, the backyard of someone living in the city. It's very much in the backyard of someone who's living in regional rural Australia. What happens if these things are abandoned and we're just left with this kind of infrastructure that, you know, that's no longer useful? Or, you know, it's asking a lot of that community as opposed to the community that sucks up most of the energy.
I think if you share the profits from those projects around with the community, they will be maintained. And because the community is incentivized, because they're earning profit from it, they'll keep doing it. 45% of Australia is grazing land. You only need a tiny fraction, less than 1/100th of our grazing land, as wind and solar to achieve complete zero emission Australia. We've already done a great project of installing machines in rural Australia to feed the cities, right? Except those machines stand on four legs, and we got 30 odd million cows and 100 million sheep in 1/100th of the footprint of those cows and those sheep. And in fact, in footprints that they can share. And we now find that if you put sheep in the paddock with the solar cells. The water condenses underneath the solar cell and makes really tasty green grass under the solar array, and the sheep eat it and get fatter and healthier. Like, there's, it's all win-win-win-wins, and really in the context of Australian land use, this is going to look like a much better idea than dedicating so much land to cloven-hoofed animals, which really has been terrible on, in its degradation on these, a lot of these, the fragile Australian continent.
You're talking about massive mind shifts here, but at the same time, you know, the way you talk about regional Australia, it seems to me that perhaps people in the bush are probably more open to this change. Would that be fair to say?
I'm not a stranger to the bush. You know, my first job was actually in the steel industry, and I grew up spending summers working on a friend's sheep farm, and, you know, I've dagged and docked, and on the book tour, I had the opportunity to visit a lot of the regional towns and centres, and on in one case, I tagged along with Helen Haynes, the independent member for NDI. These rural towns run on the strength of the country women, and they organize and they know what's good for the community, and they advocate for their community and they get it done. And she's been advocating for the solar, now she's advocating for the community batteries. And when you're out there in the community, there is like town after town after town that I visited. The person running the local community battery was a woman. The person doing the putting the solar on the, or as a committee putting the solar on the roof of the Bolo or the RSL, run by women. And I, there was this, you know, I think the men still have their egos a little bit involved in the sound of the V8, and you know, men are a little, and this is true of me as all rural Australian men, a little slower to change their minds about things than we might maybe should be. But I think that they're seeing the economic benefits, they're seeing what this can do for their community when you generate your own energy, when you become independent. It's making the communities more robust and resilient in times of bushfire. It's making the communities more resilient if there are power outages elsewhere in the grid. You know, I think the communities are seeing this benefit, and they're really doing it for themselves already. It's just a tragedy that the Australian government hasn't been rowing the boat with them as much as it could for the last decade. Now, hopefully we've turned that corner and we're going to push harder. I think we can go even more aggressively than what we're seeing so far, but the communities are wanting it. The government's finally coming around. The economics are stacking up. You know, and honestly, I think there's a role for, you know, metaphorically, I think the Country Women's Association might just show the world how to solve climate change.
And I started off saying you were looking for a test case. Have you found a test case of a town that's willing to take this on as a whole community? Those 1,000 people that could possibly kind of test case this for the world?
We're discussing with communities in South Australia, hugely positive feedback. We've got a number of inner city suburbs in Melbourne and Sydney that all want to do it. There's some Tasmanian towns that are just doing it for themselves now. I'm in a, you wouldn't call it rural regional town, but I'm in a seaside regional town. And we just, in 5 days, we got 1,000 respondents saying that they'll sign up. How do we become the first all electric zero emission suburb in Australia? So everywhere we're going, we're seeing much more demand than I think people realize or the government recognizes, because people have been listening to the stories and they know that this is the future. People have been experiencing the droughts and the bushfires and the floods and the rains. So we know what's coming if we don't fix it. So I think the willingness is extraordinary out there amongst the Australian public. There's, you know, there's still a few people who don't believe you can cook on a wok unless it's gas, who don't think you can eat a barbecue unless it comes with a side of half-burned hydrocarbons, who don't believe that you'll be able to, you know, ever have a truck that can go drive all day electrically. But, you know, all of those little cultural things, battles are being won by the electric technology just being cleaner, easier, cheaper.
Dr. Saul Griffith, he's the author of The Big Switch, Australia's Electric Future. Thanks very much for talking to Australia Wide.
Cheers.
You're listening to ABC Australia Wide.
And you're with me, Sinead Mangan, and that's Australia Wide for this Tuesday. Remember, you can podcast the show or listen back to the programme through the ABC Listen app or by visiting the Australia Wide website. Just search for ABC and Australia Wide. And you can always email us, australiawide.radio@abc.net.au. I'm Sinead Mangan. I hope you have a lovely evening. Cheerio.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.